Hello everyone, and welcome to the Death by Adaptation podcast, a bi-weekly book club which is one classic book and compare and contrast it against its cinematic adaptations. I'm your host, Niccolò Brasso, and I am joined, as always, by the great Ewan Gledow. How are you doing, Ewan?
I feel like my brain's falling away like a wet cake. But good, I'm doing well. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing very well, very, very well. We actually met in person, finally.
We did.
It happened. If people didn't see it on the social media, we both went to the Venice Film Festival in the beginning of September. We had a grand time. We killed ourselves watching movies, eating very little, and
drinking
writing
lots.
A lot of reviews. Drinking lots. Drinking lots.
Yeah, on my end, there was a lot of drink.
I drank lots of spritz. You were more of a vodka fan.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
But we both survived the festival experience and the festival fatigue. And we're back with a very special episode to commemorate our trip to Venice. We wanted to talk about one of the films that premiered there, one of the most anticipated movies of the year, for which we both read the book. Before we start, as always, if you're watching us on YouTube or if you're listening on Spotify and on Apple, Google, wherever you are, consider following us, consider leaving a like, 5 stars, whatever rocks your boat, we deeply appreciate it. And now, let's talk about Blonde.
Miss Monroe, it's time!
A kiss on the hand.
How'd you get your start?
Maybe.
What start?
In movies.
Quite continental. But diamonds are a girl's best friend.
I guess I was discovered.
Men grow cold as girls.
I know you're supposed to get used to it.
And we all lose our charms in the end.
But I just can't.
Square cut or pear shape.
I've played Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe. I can't face doing another scene with Marilyn Monroe.
Liz Carol Oates wrote the novel Blonde in the year 2000. It's a massive, massive book.
Huge.
Probably the longest we've done since it, I want to say, last year.
Grinch was pretty long. That was...
Grinch is long in my heart.
His heart's too big.
His heart is too big. Like 3 times as big or whatever.
Yeah.
But Joyce Carol, funnily enough, she started writing Blonde as a short story, and then it kind of turned into a novella, and it was like, yeah, it's around, like, you know, 100 pages long, just this story about being, you know, about Marilyn Monroe. Just, you know, let's not mention her by name. Let's just get lost in this weird world of her dark inner thoughts. And then similarly to Chuck Palahniuk with Fight Club, she was like, actually, there's a lot here to talk about. And when she says there's a lot, she means that she spent years researching Marilyn's life, watching all of her movies, reading all of her available diaries, poems, and all of that, to write probably the definitive novel on
yes.
Marilyn Monroe, with an emphasis on novel. This is a fiction work. Primarily to not get, you know, prosecuted and brought to law by the estates of other people that are mentioned in this story. Probably starting with Marilyn herself. But it is explicitly said that this is a work of fiction. This is not trying to be an a biography of sorts. And that is a point of contention between people. This is a graphic portrayal of Marilyn's life, starting from when she's a child, abused by her mother, up until the very end, where she maybe killed herself. Maybe she was killed by someone? Who knows? We'll get to it. Ewan, what are your thoughts on the novel Blonde?
I think it's very smart. It's very well written. Mm. I think they're just sort of broad strokes for how I feel about Joyce Carol Oates' work on this, because it is seminal. It is such an inspiringly great piece. Not so because it's a clear doc. Let's be fair, the fiction tag on this is just, you know, legal cover.
Yes.
You cannot be so intimate and accurate and open-ended about the life of Marilyn Monroe without sort of wading into that non-fiction arena. But Joyce Carol Oates is an extremely, extremely smart writer and manages to both deflect the allegations that this is an autobiography or an adaptation, and at the same time gives herself and the characters within the book security, whether that is through a name change or a change of pace or even just sort of a little detail change that still connotates with the real world. It is remarkable, and it is long. It is very long, so much so that we've had to push this episode back a couple of times because someone didn't finish the book in time.
We are living busy lives, busy schedules.
Yeah, I am. As it turns out, when you are doing so much, I was going to list what I've been up to, but then I just realized how much I've actually been doing, and we'd be here for most of the episode.
You can say it for the end.
That roundup thing. My thoughts on this book can essentially be summarized with, I think this is fiction or non-fiction, this is the definitive way to learn about Marilyn Monroe's life. It is surprisingly controversial. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect to find it controversial myself, but yes, it's very brutal and very gruesome, but also very controversial. And looking at the discourse online for it, where people were saying it's very brutal, it's very gruesome, it's very controversial, but then looking at the reasons they had for thinking it was brutal, gruesome, controversial, they didn't match up with what I was thinking. What I was thinking was kind of, this is really horrifying to see. And, you know, my work in journalism's kind of, you know, the ghoulish side, shall we say. We're appealing to people that want to know more about lives of celebrities. And Joyce Carol Oates does that with this quite a lot. It does appeal to the people that want to know more about Marilyn Monroe, but from the perspective of, this is really interesting because it's really horrible. It's the true crime anatomy for novelizations. But most people were just upset that Joyce Carol Oates was talking about what happened to Marilyn Monroe. I know it's a fiction, but what happened in the book, you know, it's the scene with the, what do you call it, whether her skirt was blown up by the vent or the...
Yeah, from the semi-reach.
Yes. Or her relationships with, like, famous baseball players and Arthur Miller. These are not controversial in the sense that they didn't happen. They did happen. The controversy behind it is the action, not the reporting of it. And I'm sure we'll get onto the film later, because the discourse around that is already just something special. But the book is great in the sense that it does have a humane level to Marilyn. We are clear in what her process is. She is a clearly vulnerable person. She's clearly someone with aspiration and talent and skill and intelligence. It's set out very clearly and very plainly in the book, and it's shown obviously and just written well. And it creates a nice ballast to the horrors that she actually had to encounter and endure, which is just damnable to say the least. And it's very emotive. It's very emotive, Joyce Carol Oates' work here. You can tell there's dedication. The dedication pays off.
Yep. I couldn't agree more, honestly. This was stunning. This is one of the rare books that actually floored me. I just got halfway through and I thought, like, I'm never going to be finishing this book. Like, it's just going to keep on going on in my life, even though I'm going to reach the final page. It's just going to stick with me and keep on going and going. Joyce Carol Oates did something brilliant in this, where she kind of knew she was going to be, you know, talking quite a lot about Marilyn Monroe, or rather Norma Jean Baker, delving into her life. And so the fact that she uses different ways of narration, different writing styles. Some chapters are 2 or 3 pages long. Other chapters are 70 or 80 pages long. You are seeing it from the perspective of Norma Jean. You're seeing it from the perspective of her husband, from other people. There are scenes where Marilyn goes to a bar with Joe DiMaggio and you're reading the thoughts of other people in the restaurant, seeing their dinner unfold in front of their eyes. It's such a compelling and unique way of approaching this subject that is at the core of the story for me. This is inherently voyeuristic. Marilyn Monroe, or Norma Jean, like, she's always been under the spotlight ever since she was starred in Asphalt Jungle in 1950 by John Huston, up until the very end after she did The Misfits, everything that happened with Kennedy behind closed doors that we don't necessarily know all of. it was very uncomfortable and it was too much for her. And that's something that shines through very much in the book, but also in her personal writing that Carol Oates took inspiration from. She was afraid of the world. She did not want to be that famous. She just wanted to be herself. She started using aliases. She fell into deep depression. She found herself in very troubling physical and sexual relationships with men that saw her as this doll, basically, to play with, to control, to manipulate. And she always gave 100% of her heart in those relationships. It's heartbreaking. Like you said, it's brutal. It's a lot to unpack. And I can see why it's uncomfortable. I think taking someone that's been idolized to that level, seen in this pristine, pure form as a sex pot in major Hollywood movies, seeing her in a more human way, which also takes into account all of her romances in a very stark and straightforward way, you know, the way Carol also presents sex and nudity in this book. It's very genuine, often lyrical. Just the book in general is very poetic. You read a passage earlier. That's a banger passage. You took it just randomly from the book. You can open any page in this book and there will be poetry. There will be a quote worthy of a Tumblr post, you know. You can make an whole album just with quotes from this book and be like 1,000 different notes. It's great. It's genuinely stunning, stunning book. But you briefly... Oh, sorry, you want to go. I thought you wanted to say something.
No, I was just about to say it's just on the whole, it is a thick book. And just like you said, you can open it any page and pick out something poetic, and I'm going to do it again.
Go for it.
I'll give it a go. You can hear the... Okay, page 314. It was that party, the mega millionaire Texas oil man with the eye patch wanting to invest in the studio, the amazing bird and animal menagerie outdoors amid tall candles on posts and a trick translucent paper moon above the palm trees lighted from within, so guests thought there were two moons in the sky. That party, the Gemini, who'd come uninvited but driving a borrowed Rolls, were watching over Norma Jean from a distance. That is a hefty sentence, but it introduces you to two crucial characters. It also sets a beautiful scene that is so unique to Joyce's craft and the Hollywood aesthetic she managed to capture. The two moons, the stolen roles. It's very... I hate this. I don't know whether to say it or not because I've not read it in years, but it's very Great Gatsby-ish in the prolific nature of big parties and roaring 20s aesthetic living on into the 1950s. And as we can probably gather, the Hollywood aesthetic was sort of the same with all the parties that went on. And in capturing that, and the visualization of it is so clear. It humanizes people that did exist, but we never met, but are on the page now so that they can exist. And it's a long, winding road that Joyce gets very, very right. Scarily so.
Yes. Duality is at the core of the narrative. You know, there's the duality of Norma Jean, the real woman, and Marilyn Monroe, the stage persona, the actress, the blonde that everyone wants. That's one of the more fascinating things. I did not know that Marilyn, let's call her Marilyn from now on, it's easier in a way. But I didn't know that Marilyn was not a natural blonde, that she was actually more of a brunette type of gal, and she had to dye her hair.
Hair like mine.
Yeah, gloriously brune. And like that's part of her duality, the fact that she had a threesome, basically, the so-called Gemini that you read earlier, with Eddie G and Cass Chaplin.
Eddie G. Robinson and Cass Chaplin, yeah.
There you go. Also two the sons of two Hollywood legends, living in the shadow of their fathers. They kind of envy Marilyn for her ability to just, you know, you can be yourself, you can build your own future. We had our own future set up before we were even born. I know there's this thing been trending on Twitter in the past few weeks where people are like, oh, the Babylon trailer is out. Oh, everyone's doing these love letters to cinema. We need more hate letters to cinema. And watching and reading Blonde, it's not so much a hate letter to cinema as the movies themselves, but it's a hate letter to Hollywood, to the way movies are made, to the way these people are just chewed up and sped out. And it's uncomfortable, you know. Marilyn was a victim of the casting couch. Not nice, not a very nice scene to read unfold. Very dark, very troubling. And there's so many parts like that. And one of the more interesting elements to me is how all of the male characters in here are pretty much just garbage. That can be seen as kind of more of a proto-feminist choice from Carol Oates to, you know, kind of condemn the patriarchy. But it works and it fits and it tracks with real life. You know, the first husband of Marilyn before she was actually Marilyn, he wanted her to be just a housewife, you know, married her very young when she was barely 18. Then he was drafted for World War II. When he came back, he found out that she was a pinup girl. She was making a living by just taking photographs, and he hated that. He hated her freedom. He hated the fact that she posed in the nude, and was not successful per se. But you know, people loved looking at her, so he left her. Same thing kind of happened with Joe DiMaggio. He was envious of her fame, and he left her. And even the only relationship with Arthur Miller that kind of seems, you know, a bit nice, a bit more positive, it ends up being dark in its own way, because he doesn't see her as Norma Jean or as Marilyn. He sees her as the kind of dreamy manifestation of Magda, this babysitter that he was in love with when he was just 10 years old. And so everyone puts their own hopes and dreams into this woman, and she can never fulfill them. She tries. She's a good actor. She's a great actress, I'd even say, and that shines through in the book. But she's always patronized, and she's always seen as someone that ultimately she wasn't. Just heartbreaking. In the end, she was alone.
It's tragic, but it's also remarkable that you should say that. She is seen as something she is not. Just reminded me of the film and the outcry of it. Because the book and the film, I'm sorry to just jump into the film, but
we can do this. Let's go into the film.
The book and the film do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. One has been lauded, one of them has been heavily, heavily criticized, because visualization takes two different forms. Joyce Carol Oates visualizes the Hollywood aesthetic, the dynamics of the 1950s, and the period of Marilyn Monroe's life that is troubled. We'll use that word, troubled, because it is harrowing, it's horrible to read. To see it is something else, because you don't have control over what you are seeing. If you read something, you are visualizing it yourself. It's like the age-old example is Hermione's hair color in Harry Potter. People were shocked when Emma Watson was cast. With Blonde...
Public outcry.
Public outcry is what drives great movies. I'm not saying Blonde is great. I think Blonde is a good movie. But I think the outcry for it is... It's not unjustified. It is, however, the main point of not just the movie, but also the book, is to explore the exploitation of an artist who, for better or worse, was much more talented than she was ever perceived by the book and the film, as well as the people of the time. And it's been surprising to see how it's been received. I can see people not liking this for the artistic direction from Andrew Dominik. I can see people not liking it because of Ana de Armas' performance. I can see people not liking it because Adrien Brody shows up for about 20 minutes. I cannot see people disliking it because it does what the book did, which is explore the dramatized life of someone that was horribly treated.
Yeah,
it's fine line between exploitation and articulation. And I don't think the book or the film necessarily exploit it. They look into the exploitation. That does not mean they are exploiting her.
Yeah, it's an interesting beast, because the book came out in the year 2000, and it was actually already adapted in 2001.
It was
like a 5-hour miniseries that I refused to watch. It stars Poppy Montgomery in the cast. You also have like Emily Browning, Patrick Dempsey plays the son of Chaplin, which is a choice, I guess, in terms of casting, but it was not successful. People barely remember it existed. But there was someone who read the book and really loved it, and you mentioned him, Andrew Dominik. Andrew Dominik loved Blonde, loved it so much that he wrote a script and he wanted to get it made, and he couldn't. He made The Assassination of Jesse James by the cover of Robert Ford, still tried to make Blonde, couldn't. He made Killing Them Softly. I was like, can I make Blonde now? No. He made a documentary. No. It kept getting like slammed in the face with the script because it was too controversial. It was too out there. The TV version was a bit more soft, you know, in the protest. No nudity because nudity is uncomfortable. Some of the more harsh stuff, you know, you cannot put on television. Until Netflix gave him the green light. The year 2018, late 2018, they were like, yeah, of course, man, go for it. We're giving you a lot of money to make this movie. He cast Ana de Armas. He shot it in just 41 days, right before COVID hit at the end of 2019. He edited it. It was ready in early 2021. And Netflix said, nope, this is NC-17. This is too much for us. We're not going to put it out there. But thankfully, you know, contractual obligations, Andrew Dominik stood his ground. They ultimately gave in. They gave him the opportunity to, you know, fulfill his own vision and bring it into the world. And by the time of recording, the movie is, I want to say, like 1 week away from coming out on Netflix. So we are going deep into spoilers now with both the book and the film to tackle some of the differences. So listeners and viewers, beware of everything going on forward.
It's impossible to talk about Blonde without talking about the major events of the book and of the film.
Yes. There's some major differences that kind of surprised me. Let's just get into that, actually. Just in general, did you like the movie? Because I remember of all the movies of the festival, we kind of avoided going way deep into that because we want to save some fresh combo for this discussion.
I did enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was good. I didn't think it was great. I don't know whether or not that's because I was very tired at that point. Or because
it was one of the last days, yeah. It was like the 8th day, 9th day, actually.
I remember as soon as Blonde finished, I went drinking. So I've doused my thoughts in vodka. No, I remember finishing it. I thought it was very good. I thought it was the same thoughts I had with Bardo, where it was far too long and far too artistic and self sort of aggrandizing and very long. But when it focused up on its message and it really got to its core, it is a very strong piece. The issue, of course, is unavoidable, and we will talk about audience perspectives, I'm sure.
Well, we'll get into
this
that.
Way, it was either this or another style in the form of Bohemian Rhapsody, and it is up to audiences to decide which one they want, and I'm pretty sure the former, which is controversial Netflix films with a bit of artistic flair, is better than the latter, which is Oscar-winning edit-thons, which... I don't know. It's not much of a choice to me. I didn't expect to get so sort of defensive about a film I thought was all right. I'll probably never watch Blonde again. I probably won't speak about it after the end of this podcast.
Pray for it's the better film. For both of us.
Well, it's none of the performances like blew me away. None of the artistic decisions exploded on the screen. I just thought it was very good. It's fine. It's all right. It's. The offense people take is not with the film, but with the adaptation of Marilyn Monroe, because a lot of people are saying, just leave her alone. Well, you know, there is an argument to make for that, and I would agree to some extent that the ghoulish nature of Hollywood is to adapt, and take tragedy into Oscar bait. But at the same time, the people saying that this is a ghoulish representation of Marilyn Monroe will be the same people that were front and center to take snapshots of Harry Styles on the red carpet, so I have little sympathy. With that narrative, because the same people aggrandizing and saying that this is the worst thing ever are also probably the worst people ever, the ones that are on the front lines of the red carpet going, Harry, please sign my arm. This is not the worst thing ever. And I remember when we had that lovely pasta when you got attacked by 5 wasps, I said you could not defend a 5-star rating for this movie, because despite not liking the core of it, if you don't like the emotional elements of it, which are not up for debate, these are matter of fact, this is what happened, and this has been adapted. We don't get upset when Bronson is depicted as a bad man in the Tom Hardy biopic. That's just the facts of it. That's just what happened. And I remember saying to you, it's almost impossible to justify a 5-star rating, because regardless of what you feel about regardless of what emotions you feel for Marilyn Monroe, I felt shocked and horrified to hear about Marilyn Monroe in this film. To see her depicted that way is disgusting, but it is also accurate. It is correct. That is what happened. And to see people say, this is a travesty, she wouldn't have wanted this. Like, yeah, I can imagine she wouldn't have wanted to live through that. Adapting it gives a lot of credence to exploring Marilyn Monroe's life, because it's one, it's never been done before aside from Joyce Carol Oates' book, and two, is not as popular as you'd think it would be. For Netflix to take this project really startles me, because this is not a Netflix project. Andrew Dominik has done something here that is not quite suitable for a Netflix audience. It's not, it's the same for Bardo again. These two films don't click with the, oh, I've just finished work and I want something easy to watch, is still game, still on Netflix. These are not films that a Netflix audience is going to enjoy.
It's, and at the same it's the time, end of an era, in a way.
It is. It is the end of an era. And it's from the Netflix films we saw, Bardo, Blonde, Athena.
White Noise. Not,
White Noise. These are not commercially viable films. These are films that really push the artistic merit of not just the style of the director, but also what is expected of a streaming platform movie. And, you know, Banshees of Inisherin, that's a Disney Plus piece, isn't it?
It's Fox, yeah. Searchlight.
Fox, yeah. That is not a streaming movie. That's something that, you know, I don't want to harp on because I don't really like going to the cinema that much. But it is a cinema movie. It's not something you just stick on in the background, as in Bruges has sort of been leveled with now, because it's on every streaming platform because it's that good. But it earned that reputation rather than immediately came from it.
Yeah.
It's a struggle to feel much sympathy for people that don't like these movies.
Yeah.
Sorry, I feel like I went off on one and I don't remember what I've said, so I'll probably repeat myself in about 5 minutes.
No worries. Just kind of before delving into the whole, you know, way the movie is being received by people that haven't seen it, kind of with prejudice both thrown at the book as well, because some of those people have read the book and they're like, you know what, I hate the book and so I'm gonna hate the movie. Review bombing in general is just maddening. Like, why do you care that much? What does a movie's rating on Rotten Tomatoes, on Letterboxd mean to you? That maybe five people won't watch it because of that? Hooray, you're fighting the real fight here.
It's people that are uncomfortable with themselves that do that, I think.
Kind of deny other people something else because, you know...
To deny other people access right to art is to deny the fact that somebody could like something that you feel reprehensible anger towards. You know, I really hate La La Land. I'm not going to sit on Letterboxd and say, please don't watch this film. It does for jazz what it does for Marilyn Monroe. It's not an equivalency that's needed. You don't need to say to people, I'm not letting you watch this. It's anti-gatekeeping. People can form their own opinions, regardless of whether or not you think it's morally right that Marilyn Monroe's life has been depicted for the first time on the big screen. It's not really anything you can do about it. I know there's a petition going around to have Netflix cancel the release of the film. That's not going to stop them.
That's laughable.
It's kind of the equivalent of sharing a charity link on your Instagram story, but not actually donating anything. It's the sense of action rather than the act of action. There are things you can do to avoid being angry by Blonde. For example, not watching it. You don't need to tell other people not to watch it, because if they do watch it, what they'll find is a good film, a completely forgettable film. And let's be fair, I think the estimations for it are of being like an Oscar success are heavily weighed on the fact that Academy Awards love to give credit to actors that are portraying people that have died as a way of forgiving themselves. I think that's disgusting. But just because I find that disgusting does not mean I'm going to go on Letterboxd.com and say, you shouldn't watch this movie. It's morally reprehensible and depicts a gruesome, horrible life.
Because that's star.
It's what happened. That's it. That's what happened. It would be very difficult to warrant a documentary on Freddie Mercury that had him playing, like, I don't know, covers of the Smiths. It didn't happen, therefore it cannot be shown. It would be great if Marilyn Monroe's life was just littered with awards and success. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that she was worthy of that success. Some Like It Hot is one of an endless supply of incredible examples of her work. You find it in the book and you find it in the film that she is an incredibly talented individual. She knows about Tolstoy. She knows about Dostoevsky. She is keen to work in Shakespearean theatre. That is adapted perfectly by Joyce Carol Oates and Andrew Dominik. The issue is not the representation of Marilyn Monroe, but the fact that people have latched onto the sexualization of her.
Mm-hmm.
That was nothing new. That was the juicy gossip of the time, and it was really popular, and it still is, because, like it or not, you are still talking about it. Not you, Nick, I mean, just in general. I'm addressing the audience. Like it or not, they are still talking about what they hate about this movie and about this book that they probably haven't read. And having read over 700 pages of Joyce Carol Oates writing about Marilyn Monroe, I can safely say she's probably the leading expert on Marilyn Monroe, fiction or not. That's the benchmark. We're not going to have a better biographical, fictional piece on Marilyn Monroe than this, ever. That's it. That's the limit. Because like all big events in Hollywood, like all great artists that have been adapted to films, they have a breaking point and they just get lost in this sea of influence. The Elvis biopic, that's a nip in the bud now. I know Sofia Coppola's doing one on Priscilla Presley, but after that, the interest will wane. We will move on to the next subject for controversy and documentation. And in about 4 years' time, when people go back to Blonde and think, oh, this is actually pretty good, that's too little too late. The ship has sailed, come back and sailed again. I'm not saying people need to appreciate and love this film, because they don't. I don't appreciate or love this film entirely. I think it's good. I think it's a strange little cacophony of ideas and a faithful adaptation, which is the key thing. It is a faithful adaptation of Joyce Carol Oates.
You'd say it's faithful.
I would. I'd say it's faithful in large chunks. I'm talking about specifically the Arthur Miller stuff, which I think mainly because I'm a writer as well. I just like seeing people adapted to the screen, and I think Adrian Brody's possibly his best performance in a long while, but that's not saying much since the last film I saw him in was a straight-to-DVD action film. What was it called? Some like Grease or something. Not Grease, that's really John Travolta.
I remember the poster of it where he looks like a heavily photoshopped with a beard or like goatee or something.
Oh, Clean, it's called Clean. Yeah. But it's got good performances in it. It's got some surprising people in it as well. Sarah Paxton is in it as Miss Flynn, which is always great to see because Lie, Lie is a fantastic film. Bobby Cannavale does well as the ex-athlete. Julianne Nicholson, people forget, is in it as well. Superb work as Gladys. This is a film that I think, I don't even know if it's controversial. So I think a lot of respect has gone into this film when adapting Monroe's life. I think you can make the argument that it is over-sexualized. You can make the argument that it is ghoulish or uncomfortable or controversial. And you cannot separate that thought from the fact that Marilyn Monroe's life was all of those things as well. That's just fact. That's not an opinion. That's not something that's going to shock anyone. That was her life. That's as horrible as it may sound, that was it. That you can only work with what you've got. If what you've got upsets people and makes them feel absolutely shocked at how you've sexualized a great artist, then that's what else? What's the alternative? Not doing that, then it's not an accurate depiction.
Yeah. To give my 2 cents on the movie.
Yes, go on. Sorry, I feel like I've eaten up about half an hour defending a film I'm never going to watch again.
I will say, actually, I would say this is bordering on being a great film. We've watched it actually a week ago. It's probably like when we're recording this, it's on the 14th and we saw it on the 8th. So it's been
a week ago already?
It was, yeah.
Man.
And it's coming up on the 18th on Sunday.
Pizza in that time. for patriotism's sake.
But it is a movie that stuck with me, surprisingly. I left the screening really liking it. I was a bit cold on some of the things in it. And with hindsight, the only problems that I have are unavoidable. There are problems with the adaptation itself in terms of length, in terms of content. There is so much that is cut in this film that just pains me a little bit. It goes from her childhood straight into her first acting gig. It's just a rapid fire montage of like, there's no first marriage, there's no life in the orphanage. So even the character of Fleece is completely abandoned. So it goes straight into her acting in the asphalt jungle after the casting couch. And then it's from there, it's a bit more faithful. And then after the Arthur Miller stuff, it just goes very quickly again because it cuts out the entirety of the making of The Misfits, which I found very heartbreaking from Miller's perspective because he wrote this movie, this screenplay for her. And there's so many good bits in that section of the book. But Andrew Dominik, rightfully so, I'd say, kind of cuts out all of that fat. Because in the end, it is repetitive on a purely thematic level. And you say, okay, what matters here? What matters is showing the duality of Norma Jean and Marilyn Monroe. It matters to see how monstrous Hollywood was to her. It matters to see how broken she was inside because of her own psychic, because of her own psyche and because of the trauma that she suffered as a child because of her mother. Constantly living in this search for her father. That's why she called so many of her fiancés and husbands daddy, daddy, daddy. She's always looking for that paternal figure, someone that maybe worked in Hollywood, maybe was in the book. It says that maybe was Charlie Chaplin or Clark Gable. It leans very heavily into that. But I found that very, very touching. And it's Andrew Dominik does something that I've never seen before. It kind of takes the way that Michael Bay shot Transformers The Last Night, where it's constantly changing the aspect ratio, and he actually used it for a good reason. This film keeps cutting back and forth between color and black and white, and between 4:3 Academy ratio to widescreen to full screen. It puts you into the mind space of Marilyn, of Norma Jean, of being lost in this colorfuler, tragic world, unsure of who's good and who's bad, who's out there to support you and to hurt you, who's there to just, which role is reality and which role is fantasy. It put me in this very weird mindscape that just kind of sucked me in and never let go until the very end when the screen fades to white. It's one of the rare movies that was over 2 hours long and didn't feel like it to me, which I would say is a great achievement considering there were 60-minute movies that felt like 2 hours, you know, so literally, like Uncouple by Frederick Wiseman. And so to see this biopic, even though it's heavily butchered in terms of content, I do think Dominik did a very good job. And even the actual thematic changes in there, I think, are for the better. The most pleasant one was the way that the whole Kennedy thing was tackled, you know? There's no tragic, happy birthday, Mr. President. All of that is cut. It's not in the film. Bobby Kennedy is not in the film. It's just, you know, it's one scene. There's no assassin of the White House that sent out actually killer in the end. All of that is removed to just show how even the president himself, you know, used her as a piece of meat just for his own pleasure in what has to be the scene that got this movie the NC-17 rating, the borderline explicit fellatio of JFK. Just thinking about it is graphic, but even then, it's not, you know, I know it's not the Brown Bunny by Vincent Gallo, where it's just, you know, the full-on close-up. It starts off as that, but then it shows, you know, Marilyn kind of zoning out, kind of, you know, her way of tackling life was to just see all of the traumatic events as a movie. It's not happening to her, Norma Jean, the real person. It's happening to Marilyn on the screen. And in that moment, it actually kind of zooms out, which was very effective in a cinema. And it was a great dramatic effect, and it really hit me emotionally. It was just kind of like I said it before many times this word, but just tragic. You feel the tragedy of her. And that's also, I want to connect it with what you said about, you know, the fact that this is a Netflix movie. It does feel like the end of an era for Netflix, because they said, I would say like a few months ago, like 3 or 4 months ago, they said they're not going to finance any more vanity projects like Irishman, and I suspect like Blonde, like Bardo.
They've stopped financing good movies.
Financing good movies, directors that needed the support because no one else wanted to make these films, which is a shame. And I think the biggest shame is kind of similar to when I watched Roma at the Venice Film Festival. It was an overwhelming experience on the big screen and I loved it for it. When I rewatched it at home, I was like, you know what? I still really love the film, but it doesn't hit in the same way. And with the constant changes in aspect ratio, the self-awareness of the cinematic experience in Blonde, knowing that most of our listeners are not going to be able to experience it the way it was kind of meant to be seen by Dominik on the big screen, you know, projected with other people in the room. What a shame.
It is a shame. And, you know, I guess I should give my quick thoughts on the actual going to of the cinema. Because for a long time, my thoughts were, if I can watch it at home, I'm going to watch it at home, because getting to a cinema is a 40-minute train ride and some walking in between. But it was at Venice, and obviously it was, I was going to say it was a privilege to go there, but it wasn't. I worked very hard to do that. Sitting in the screening room with other people, that is an experience like no other. Mm-hmm. I think, however, the experience you had there is you are surrounded by people that are also film fans. They are there for the festival experience. When I go to the cinema in Darlington, people are usually there because it's raining outside or because they need a dark room to fondle each other. It's not an ideal experience to be watching, like, Sonic the Hedgehog 2 in that environment. Oh, God. It's not fun. And it's why I've always enjoyed watching films by myself. I will never forget the best film I've ever seen in the cinema before Venice. Not because of the quality of the film, but because I was the only person there was the front runner with Hugh Jackman. I took the first VIP seat I could find and I sat myself down. It was 10 in the morning. Incredible. Films like Blonde will always, I think this is more of an American thing. They'll rely on the atmosphere, the experience of seeing it on the big screen, like the Marvel films do, when people applaud when they see a fucking soundbite that they recognize. With Blonde, I mean, you were there for the same screen and I was. It was an icy reception at the end.
Yeah, critics did not like it.
They did not, no. Me and Robbie Collin are very much holding the line. but what I can say is that for stuff like The Whale, and even Blonde as well, there was an atmosphere in the room that you were experiencing something for the first time before everybody else with a group of select people, which is a pretty good way of bragging about us going to Venice Film Festival. But at the same time, that is an experience I've felt occasionally at the films. You know, when you go in and you realize you are seeing this for the first time, not just by yourself, but with a group of people. And sometimes that group isn't the best. Sometimes that group is not even there. But it's the experience of actually taking yourself to somewhere to watch a film. Now, I would still argue that me booting up a Blu-ray or just waiting until it drops on Sky Cinema is a lot easier. Is it better? Yeah, because I can make toasties in an air fryer at home. But it's not the way cinema was meant to be endured. I can at least agree to that. It's the most comfortable way for me to view it, but it's not the right way. And for Blonde, this is not, like Bardo, not a film to watch on like a 28-inch monitor at your desk at all. Not at all.
Yeah, you know, notifications constantly popping on the telephone, and maybe there's a dog barking outside. That's something that I really appreciate every year going to Venice, especially this year, honestly, because just I always try to create an atmosphere watching a movie when it's on the TV, because on the TV it's like, you know, I'm going to leave the phone in the other room. Everything's disconnected, just me and the screen, maybe my parents, my family. But when I'm watching it on the computer, on a tablet, like there's always something going on. There's always a noise that's distracting. And so to actually get to watch movies on the big screen, even movies that are just, you know, people talking, we've seen The Sound, you mentioned The Whale, movies that aren't cinematic in the sense of great spectacle or even great technical achievements. It's so much worth it, though. And that's honestly, like, if you're listening to this episode right now, and you are actually interested in watching Blonde, or you have already, just I hope you watch it or have seen it with the blinds closed, just you and the screen, maybe headphones if you want to fully get lost in the soundscape of it, because it's worth it. It's worth it. That's how all movies should be seen. There's something they really hated when Marriage Story came out. The people just started taking scenes out of context and trying to sell them as the entire movie. And so people were like, that's not the way the movie actually is. Those people technically did see the movie to actually trim those clips up. The fact is that while the movie was going on, they were just, you know, on their phones the whole time, or maybe taking a call, or maybe, you know, like, oh, I think the movie's still going, I'll go grab a bag of chips in the other room. And they came back, and they come back, and they're just, oh, they're screaming, oh, it's so loud, it's so exaggerated. Everything's about, like you said, sound bites. It's about out-of-context moments. And Blonde, to kind of like close the whole controversy behind Blonde is going to be destroyed by that. As soon as this episode is out, I am blocking Blonde, Marilyn Monroe, Ana de Armas on Twitter. I don't want to see anything about it, positive or negative. People are already talking about it in insufferable ways. there is, like, you know, people who have suffered assaults of various types are going to find this movie uncomfortable? Yes. Are others who also suffered assault going to find it healing in a way? Yes. Everyone is entitled to their own personal experience, and it's fine. Don't block other people from doing something. Don't shame them for liking this movie. Don't call them misogynists simply because Ana de Armas is nude for like 15 minutes out of 2 hours and 20 or 40. You know, it's 2 hours and 40. It's longer than I remember. But, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong in that. And I think the way Dominic presents it, it's male-gazy, maybe. People keep saying, like, oh, you can tell it's directed by a man. You also have people who kind of hate Andrew Arnold, who hate Jane Campion, who are women that do show explicit nudity in their movies. And I mean, even unstimulated sex. There's no shame in that. What's the difference between the two? The difference is that, you know, there's preconceived notions, there's prejudice that goes into talking about this film. And it's a shame. It's an utter shame. I think maybe rewatching this film at home without someone coughing right behind me for the entire 3 hours of the movie might help. I did love watching it on the big screen still. And it made me emotional, which is something that happened more than I'd like to admit this year's festival.
A lot of thematically similar films. Me sobbing my fucking eyes out at The Whale was not an experience I'd anticipated because I hadn't cried in years. Yeah. Just physically could not cry, and that just felt like a valve let loose. And now every day, I cry myself to sleep. I cry when I wake up. I cry when I think about having to review Blonde. I cry thinking about the Twitter discourse that's going to come from it, because Babylon's not even out yet, and the Twitter discourse around that is fucking toxic. It's awful. It's why I don't encourage people to speak to me. I don't want anything to do with it.
It's very tiring, yeah.
I can't imagine much of the Blonde discussion will be in that much good faith. I can't imagine it will ever get past the "you're a misogynist if you like this, you are an idiot if you don't" mentality, because within is a really deep and interesting understanding of Marilyn Monroe's life that does... It's like you said, they cut out the stuff about Bobby Kennedy and stuff, and it's the happy birthday scene. And I think the reason he does that is, again, it's visualizing that is just too on the nose. It's that cemented in pop culture now that to adapt it into a scene of a movie would just say, oh, it's the bit like in the bit of history. So to distract
you
from
that...
You
can watch it if you want. Just go on YouTube and you can find it.
If you really want to. It's out there.
It's rough viewing.
It is rough, but again, it's a rough movie. It's really intense. It's really uncomfortable. We're not denying that these are the emotions that it conjures. We're just explaining and trying to understand that these are the emotions it intended to conjure. This is what it was meant to do. Because the book did the same.
Exactly. And even the way it's presented, it's poetic. It's lyrical, it's gorgeous. It's one of the most stunning movies that Netflix will ever put out, probably.
I think so. I think it's a little too scattershot at times, where Andrew Dominic thinks this is his like student art project and he's trying to just pull messages and meaning out of abstract shots of rooftops.
Here's a vertical shot.
He has a vertical shot. He has a weird inconsistency with using black and white or colour film. And there's no sort of process or rhyme or reason to it. I know you said when we got out, it was like, is it meant to show Norma Jean and Blonde? Is it meant to show Norma Jean and Marilyn Monroe?
But then no, it didn't track. I read other people say that it's just, you know, it starts off as that, but the longer it goes on, the two realities kind of blur together, which is kind of why I want to rewatch the movie, because I can actually see that maybe being right, you know?
Yeah, the Who only knows? Movie I'll ever rewatch from that festival is Dreamin' Wild Again.
Hey! Deep down, your favorite film.
In my heart, I know. But in my mind, I know if I said that, I'd be shot or thrown out of the critic circle, whichever.
But yeah, it's... If I have to make one last comparison with Blonde the movie, it's Spencer by Pablo Larraín from last year.
Yes.
A fictional retelling of a real person's life. I mean, Spencer is all about 3 days. Blonde is about an entire lifetime. Yes. But there is a sense of beauty, of elegance, and as well of rawness that's very, very touching and very, like, it's aiming for something that most biopics never do. And it's also the reason why it's often misunderstood by people. I've had many arguments with viewers who found Spencer to be exploitative, you know, because it's still capitalizing on Diana Spencer's real life and her tragedy, and it shows her as this broken woman who was seeing ghosts and all of that, and it's very disrespectful. And I think the same thing is happening with Marilyn, because both of them, and that's something that I think Dominic is deconstructing as well, with showing scenes from the various movies that she acted in. Yeah. He's kind of criticizing the fact that, you know, we care so much about these people because they have been immortalized. They are immortal. You know, we have footage of Diana Spencer. We have the Marilyn Monroe happy birthday scene, as well as all of her, celebration of Kennedy, as well as all of her movies. She will always live in people's minds. Meanwhile, if you take, Marie Curie, there's very little footage of her, you know. If you take Mark Twain, fuck that. He wasn't even invented the movie camera. Like, if you take anyone before the 20th century, before the 20th century, like, there's no footage of them. There's maybe pictures, testimonials, but you can put on so much of yourself and of the way you see the world into creating fictional stories of them. And so doing the same with people that will never die. They will always be alive on the screen once you play something, like once you play one of those videos, when you play Lady Di giving a speech. It makes it more personal, it makes it more intimate. And I think Dominic is aware of that, and he wants to break that down, and people don't want that. They want stardom, they want celebrities being pure, they want them to be idols and representative of something that just doesn't exist.
Put it this way, the closest I can think to having a pure celebrity, shall we say, as adapted to a biopic is Bohemian Rhapsody. Freddie Mercury, despite his flaws in that film, was presented as a hero of music when in actual fact he was a half-decent singer at best.
Oh, shots fired.
Don't like Queen. I'm laying that down now. Night of the Opera's shite. But that's not the point. The point of what I'm saying is that I'm so glad you brought up Pablo Larraín. Because if Pablo Larraín had directed Blonde, nobody would have batted an eyelid if the content was the exact same. He did this for Jackie, he did it for Spencer, and he would have done it for Marilyn Monroe. It would have been the exact same thing that Andrew Dominic has done here. But it would have been less controversial because there would have been less arty shots. This is a very good adaptation of an even better book. And I may have just let slip the ending there for which one I'm leaning towards, but that's the matter of the fact. It is a very good adaptation of a very, very good book. And that is undeniable. I you could give this film like 2 stars and at least come out with thinking, well, you know what, it is a fair adaptation of a fictionalized novel. And what people are going to struggle with, and what I already know will dominate Twitter, is that people cannot distinguish what is accurate and what is being fictionalized for the benefit of the story, because there is no layering to Twitter. There is black and white. That's it.
That's what gets clicks, you know.
It does. I should know. But I'm more just not bothered about Twitter discussions to begin with. I've never been interested in them, and I've never engaged with them beyond talking to you or Jack and saying, nice review, buddy, because I don't want to talk to people about films on Twitter. I have a group of friends that I talk to people about movies with. Talking to strangers on the internet with fucking Cooper from Twin Peaks avatars. I don't want to engage with you. I like Twin Peaks, but not enough to have it as my profile picture. And it's the merit of, this is going to sound really snooty, and a little bit of me thinks I do mean it like this. My job is to criticize art, essentially, because I'm not good enough to make it myself. You make art, Nick. You do. You are much better than me at creating. I can only criticize. I could not do what Andrew Dominic has done. I could not even do what Uwe Boll has done for the, you know, haha, he's really bad. I couldn't do that. But what I can do is differentiate what my emotions are telling me and what I actually think of the film. They're so inherently linked. They're so important that the two go together, but at the right moment. I'm disgusted with how Marilyn Monroe is portrayed in this film. But the actual brain part of me is saying, it's accurate though, isn't it? And it is.
That's the point.
That's the point. To see Marilyn Monroe stripped naked and essentially with the Gemini and with Adrien Brody and Bobby Cannavale, it's uncomfortable, it's disturbing, and it's really disgusting. That's the point.
Yeah, I agree. Also it's kind of beautiful and tender in some ways. It all depends by context.
I'd say the most tender parts are with Adrien Brody because he's the only character that genuinely cares for Arthur Miller. Shown like when she comes back drugged up and she, you know, she doesn't know where she is and the camera's all shaking about. When he's actually concerned, asking like, "What's the problem? What's the matter?" It's not as if people weren't there for Marilyn Monroe. It's just that they were at the wrong times. And I think Dominic does well to adapt that as well, is that not everybody meant harm to Marilyn. This big thing of everybody was out there to either get money or sex from her. There were a couple of people that did actually care. Obviously not enough to steer her in the right direction because, you know, one person is going to make no difference to drop in the ocean, essentially. One person cannot fix a severely broken person that doesn't trust anyone. But it is shown in Blonde at times, which is good enough.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the ultimate tragedy of it. I do really like that Dominic changes the ending. She doesn't get snuffed by the sniper killer of JFK because she's heard some phone calls and she needs to be terminated. She's not using right now. It's a real theory by some people that she was killed by him. But I do like that he goes for the suicide approach where she ended her life. And I think that's the thing. Like, she was always surrounded by people. Some of them cared, like Arthur Miller, but even then he cared in his own egoistic way. He was still kind of, you know, projecting someone else on top of her. So he didn't really care for Norma Jean. He cared for Marilyn, who played his babysitter in a play he wrote. So he fell in love with the idea of Marilyn, like everyone else, like we did when we first saw Gentlemen Prefer Blondes or whatever else was our first Marilyn movie. So it's like, oh, you fell in love with the idea of her. Yes, and that's killed her. And that's what's going to kill Blonde.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what's killing Blonde, yes.
People have a big vision of what Marilyn Monroe is, you know. It depends on what you saw her in first, but it also depends on your relationship with her as an artist rather than just as a person. Like, I don't know anything about Marilyn Monroe before I read this book.
Yeah,
I didn't know a thing. All I knew was that she was a very good artist, very good actor, very good singer, had great ideas, was in some, like, Hot was in All About Eve. That was all I knew. And it's not changed my perspective of her work. Her work is still incredible. It's changed my perspective of how she was treated, of how she was living. But that doesn't change the fact that Blonde is accurate in its depiction. It doesn't change the fact that she's still a very good artist. It doesn't change the fact that she's got credits in dozens of great movies.
Yeah. And I think people should take it less as a moral biopic, but not only a criticism of the world of Hollywood, but also, like, you know, stardom and fame. Like you said in the beginning, like, you know, people get obsessing over Harry Styles or Hugh Jackman or Julianne Moore and Kate Blanchett, kind of like, you know, dying to just, you know, touch them. All of these things, it's ultimately what killed Marilyn. Yeah. It's what destroyed her. And if you're reading the book, sure, you can. Of course, it is about her, but also it should be a call for to just treat these people as people, as human beings, as people like us that started from nothing, kind of, you know. And so it's kind of ironic that I think terrific casting getting Ana de Armas, because she wasn't that big when he cast her in like mid 2019.
Yeah, it's
after Knives Out. Yeah. After the No Time to Die and the whole Ben Affleck story, like the parallels between the two are eerie. I would love to know if the Armas herself is aware of kind of the similarities that are happening between the two of them. who's the real Ana de Armas? We don't know. Who's the real Matthew, what's his name? Adrian Brody. I was going to say Matthew Dominic. Who's that? I don't know. Who's the real Adrian Brody? Like, everyone's putting on a facade, and Marilyn put on a facade. And for people to ultimately go watch the movie, and that's kind of my last point on all of this, where I think, like, why this is going to have so much shitstorm that Spencer and other movies didn't get. People are going to watch this because it's on Netflix. If it were on Prime, yes, the same thing would happen. Like, it's going to streaming. It's going to be readily available for people to watch, because if they had to go to a movie theater to watch it, like a Crimes of the Future or a Titan, movies that are far more controversial in their content, more explicit in terms of nudity and violence and whatnot, it wouldn't have the same level of discourse because people have to pay for it, like, directly. And when it comes out, it's like, you know, it's kind of dumped into streaming or whatever. Meanwhile, this has been getting way too much press, way too much coverage. Netflix wants to make some money on it, and it's going to back, like, blow up in their face. And that's a shame.
I think it already has, but it's because the same people complaining about Blonde and its depiction of Marilyn Monroe are the exact same people that, if she were alive today, would be waiting outside of the red carpet, waiting outside of restaurants for an autograph or a photo. Yeah. You cannot play ball in both parks. You can have one or the other. It's why when I was at Venice with you, I was very nervous about going to celebrities because I didn't want to bother them like everybody else. Mm-hmm. It's hard to disassociate yourself from an actual person. You know, Marilyn Monroe was a person. She had thoughts, emotions, feelings, career, analytics. You know, she had prestige. She still does have prestige. Blonde isn't going to take away any of that. It's not going to harm her legacy. But what it will do is identify with this idea that she was more than a star power. She was actually, mm-hmm, you know, she was bigger than Hollywood at times. She was the face of the place.
She was a writer. She wrote poems.
She wrote, yeah.
I actually got the book. I bought it recently. It's called Fragments, I want to say, that contains all the letters and poems she wrote. I'm yet to start it, but I'm looking forward to that.
How many people complaining about Blonde depicting her as just a piece of meat are going to know about that book, do you think?
Very few.
Yeah.
Barely anyone.
And how many people do you think that are going to watch Blonde and complain about it being a poor adaptation have actually read Blonde?
More than people who know Fragments exist, but still not enough.
It's a film that is not going to age well, not because of its qualities, but because of the reaction to it.
Like a stigma, it's always going to be attached to it.
Yeah, it's going to have a stigma, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see this as an award contender. Maybe...
No.
Maybe technical achievements, if there's nothing else that kind of overshadows it in terms of popularity. If we're to believe
news reports, Babylon's already won Best Actress, so...
Babylon's won everything, you know?
Yeah, it hasn't come out yet. Best short film. That trailer alone. Yeah. I think
best trailer.
Best trailer award. I hate stuff. That's another reason I don't get involved in Twitter. It's like, I don't want to spend 3 hours discussing a trailer with strangers when I don't even watch trailers.
Same.
Not the time. Like, I went into Blonde knowing it was about Marilyn Monroe. That was it. I came out with an enjoyable experience and a shock at how many people hate it because it does what it sets out to do correctly. What else can be expected? What's the end goal? Is it Marilyn Monroe pulling out a machine gun and mowing down everybody that wronged her? If you want to watch that,
Tarantino version,
like Atomic Blonde on that, like. I don't get what people expected. I think it's not even that expectations were high for this. Expectations were just different from any perceptible notion of the real world.
Yeah. What do you think, Ewan, at the end of the day? Mm. I know, we know the answer, but still.
Yeah.
Which do you prefer? The book or the movie Blonde?
I think I prefer the book. Mainly because I think it does well to counteract what Dominic can't with the criticism he's going to be leveled with, which is, this is too graphic or it's too on the nose. The book has the benefit of, it is your imagination at work there. You are to blame for what is going on in your own mind. If you want to depict something gruesome, then that's on you. If you want to depict something beautiful and touching and intimate, that is also on you. And the only way that happens is through great writing, which is what Joyce Carol Oates has achieved here. And to do it over, you know, over 700 pages or so is a remarkable feat. I wish I could write even 10 pages that do the same thing that Marilyn Monroe is depicted as in 700 pages here. I stand by what I said. This is the definitive collection of what Marilyn Monroe's life was, with a few artistic liberties taken, not so much in the sense of it manipulates the emotional strands that we feel for her, but more in the sense of just for the narrative sake, really, just to make it make a bit more sense.
Yeah, I agree with basically every point there. I do think that the book is stronger, the book is longer, the book has more richness and texture to it. Like you said, the book benefits from being a book. It has words. It can get lost. Like, the movie becomes cinema in a more literal sense, I'm going to say, is an objective art. Like, you cannot deny what's on screen. Then the way you perceive it, the way you interpret it, of course, is inherently personal and subjective. But, you know, you show the nude body, you show the abuse, you show all of that, the way she gets slapped around and stuff. Like, that's objectively there and you cannot deny it. And the way Oates writes it is more elegant sometimes, more raw in others. Again, it fits with the theme of duality. The way she writes the book is very much constantly torn apart between beauty and ugliness, love and hate. And Dominic does the same thing. I think it really does not benefit from being rushed. It sounds weird. Should have been longer. Should have been 3 hours long. Add a bit more backstory to her before just throwing her in the casting couch after 15 minutes of the film. But still, it makes the most of it. I think it's a stunning movie to look at. I do think The Armas is great. And there's a couple sequences that are some of my favorites of the year. I think the use of Nick Cave and Warren Ellis, they do the entire soundtrack, but using White Horses from the Ghost Inn album it's so good. Just the last moment of beauty and light in the film after she gets married to Arthur Miller, just that moment is stuck with me. Just, you know, it goes for a very Malickian approach where it's all handheld, shallow focus, her with Arthur just running in the garden and calling his name. It's just, oh,
if it weren't for Jarvis Cocker and Marianne Faithfull, Nick Cave would be the greatest living artist currently. I firmly believe that. And it kind of makes sense that Andrew Dominik, after making a documentary with the man, has gone, would you like to do the soundtrack for the Marilyn Monroe biopic? Not, as I once said to my friend, the Marilyn Manson biopic. That is very different.
That's
very,
another very film. Different.
Another film entirely, yeah. I doubt that'll get made.
It's a long-lasting relationship as well. They already made the... Gavin Ellis made the soundtrack to Jesse James.
So they did, yes.
It's also another banger. Like, such an underrated composing duo, you know. But yes, these are our thoughts on Blonde by Joyce Carol Oates and Andrew Dominik. If you've listened to this episode and you got this far, thank you for listening. Have you watched Blonde? Have you read Blonde? Comment on Twitter, send us tweets, send us emails, send us private messages.
Don't send me Instagram. Anything.
Come my way. Save the poor one. It's too busy eating.
I'm putting my account
Domino's.
On private.
Just
I'm busy
putting
eating
it on private
Domino's
for a month.
To remember the queen. Oh, I still feel grim.
That's a true patriot right there.
Oh, I'm really not. I really do not. I'm going to stop myself there, but I'm sure people can infer of what I was going to say about patriotism there.
But yes, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Ewan, where can our listeners find you on social media?
Oh, they can find me in hell. Go there. No, they can find me on Cult Following, Geek Show, Narc Magazine, any volume, which I've recently just started picking up singles for because I'm bored and losing my mind. They can also get me on Clapper, Newcastle World, Daily Star, and my stuff sort of just filters out from there. They can get me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I didn't plug that first, but we do the whole thing. Twitter and Letterboxd at Ewan Gledow, EwanGledow. And you can follow my podcast account as well. Don't listen to this podcast about 1001 albums to listen to before you die. That is at DLTTpod on Twitter. You could, at the time of recording, be the 10th follower. Unless I make another burner account and follow that. But who knows?
Go follow him, people. Please.
You get to hear my voice, but in 45-minute chunks over the next decade.
Hey.
I assume I'll die before that podcast finished, though. I just ate a whole Domino's in to mark tribute to a dead woman. So, you know.
It's written in the stars. Meanwhile, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at NickyGran97, and there you can find my link tree with links to my letterbox, to my Clapper reviews and essays, to all the things that I do. You can watch my short films and videos on YouTube and Vimeo at Enjoy the Movies, because you should go there. There's some new content. There's some new art. Damn it, coming your way soon. Something including the good Ewan here as well, regarding the Venice experience.
Yes, yes.
It's going to be way less conventional than everyone involved is going to think. Is thinking right now. So, you know, it's going to be fun. Also, yes, you can follow this podcast on Twitter and Instagram, Death by Adaptation and Death by Adaptation Pod. And also check out the Uncut Gems podcast. I've been there for a lot of episodes. Work is kind of preventing me from being there every time now, but still, I love you, Jakub, and I love Randy. So go out there and support them. And stay tuned, because, you know, this was a special impromptu episode that we kind of planned. The schedule is a bit messy, but next week, the bi-weekly format is changed a little bit for this few weeks, but next week, there's a special episode where the good Jakub Flash of the Uncut Gems podcast comes to talk about Starship Troopers. So stay tuned for that. We hope you had a lovely time listening to this, and we hope you have a lovely day. Bye-bye.